Petition number 22354, Rule 2.
Terry Jefferson, Realto.
Right. The 9th Parachute Battalion was being formed from the 10th Battalion of the Essex Regiment, who were asked to volunteer. A lot of them did so, but not all of them, and so their numbers were made up from odd-bod volunteers, of which my brother and his friends were three. They came to me when I was on duty, in the medical inspection room at Hardwick, said they would come up for their training, and naturally we had a good old celebration that night down in Chesterfield. And the following day my brother had the hangover to kill all hangovers, which I cured by giving him a patent medicine of our depot dispenser, which consisted largely of flakes of aspirin in a little drop of surgical spirit, or rather pure alcohol, it wasn't surgical spirit, and laced with a lemon mixture, which was very palatable but very, very strong and blew the top of your head off, but it cured hangovers. Anyway, when he joined the 9th Battalion, I then applied to, although at that particular time I was unfit for overseas service, I applied to join the 9th Battalion, and much to my surprise, my application was accepted. So I joined the 9th Battalion on Salisbury Plain. We were then back at Bulford, but not in the same camp as I'd been in before. Bulford's a very large camp with several different barracks. And this one was a properly brick-built barrack block with its own parade ground and its own naffy, and it was a good place to be. And we remained there in training until D-Day, when we were whipped over to Normandy fairly quickly. But we were well trained for it, and we expected it.
Can you describe your own preparations for the operation, please?
My own? Yes, by that time, once again, I was running the medical inspection room, because the reason for this is because among my parachuting companions, I was getting on a bit. I was 24 years of age, and the majority of them were about 19 or 20. I'd been in the army since the outbreak of war. I'd had one or two independent jobs where I'd had to use my own initiative quite a bit. I was always being sent off on courses, and if they wanted a for instance, there was a gun accident. This all we knew. There had been a gun accident down on the coast just outside Dover. An ambulance was sent up with a medical officer, and I was grabbed to go with him. This turned out to be a young man, a batman of one of the officers, who was having girl trouble, got his girlfriend pregnant, couldn't face what he had to do, and he shot himself with his officer's revolver. Now, of all the people in my unit, I was the one who went there to see him, help to identify the fact that he was dead, just myself and the doctor. And the only way to get this fellow down from where he was to where the ambulance was down a winding staircase. There's a row of houses along the top of the cliffs between Dover and Folkestone, and just above Shakespeare Beach. And I think they were probably military houses, because there were civilians there, although the area was wired off. And the only way I could get this fellow downstairs was to chuck him over my shoulder and carry him down the winding staircase, out through the front door, and into the ambulance, by which time there were a number of ladies standing around and other odd-bods wondering what was going on. One of the ladies promptly fainted, so the medical officer had to attend to her. Not particularly amusing, but this is the kind of thing that seemed to happen to me. I was sent out, after this crash boat experience, I was sent out to a vulnerable point between Shakespeare Head and St Mary's Head, just a stretch of beach with a platoon of the Buffs, the East Kent Regiment stationed there, and I was sent there as a medical orderly to look after them, on my own again, just as a private soldier. This kind of thing has happened to me so often during my army life, I wonder why I was picked on. Anyway, that was a good little thing. I had a room in the sergeant's hut, and they used to bring me a cup of tea in the morning. I mean, we hear this story about, you know, the sergeant major bringing you a cup of tea. Well, he wasn't the sergeant major, but I got a cup of tea from one of the sergeants every morning I was there. And there again, there was no real discipline as such, a very loosely disciplined unit who were there to do a job, which fortunately was never necessary. The Germans never came. And I was dragged back to the unit again. Anyway, which is one of the reasons I joined the Paris. Sorry to digress like that. That's
all right.
It just occurred to me. Anyway, having joined the 9th Battalion, we then started serious training for D-Day. And on the 6th of June, I was as ready as I would ever be to face the enemy.
What had been your briefing for the operation?
By that time, the airborne forces had, each battalion had its own medical section of properly trained RAMC medical orderlies. And that was my job. Due again to the fact that I was older and more experienced than most, I'd been running the medical inspection room for the battalion for some considerable time, and I was more or less the medical officer who's Dr. Watts at that particular time, Captain Watts, more or less his right-hand man. We spent our working day together, my job would have been, had I actually got to where I was going, to run the advanced dressing station with him. And the rest of the section of 30 men would have been divided between the various companies so that each company had a small section of four medical orderlies with them. And the rest of them would be used as stretcher bearers and work in the advanced dressing station with me.
You knew all the details about the attack that was planned?
We were given a briefing. We knew we were going to France. We didn't know where. But we were given a briefing when we were taken to a concentration area up near Broadwell, which is near Oxford, Broadwell Airfield near Oxford. And we were put into a concentration area there where we weren't allowed out and weren't allowed contact with anybody from outside the unit itself. There again, shortly, I think it was on the 4th of June, the operation was due to take place on the 5th, but on the 4th of June, while some men were priming grenades, there was a grenade explosion. One man was killed and a couple were injured. Now, one of them was only slightly injured, but the other one had to go to hospital. There again, the medical officer and myself took him into Oxford to an EMS hospital there, where I was not supposed to talk to anybody at all, in case I let anything slip. The man was kept in hospital. I think he lost his hand. And we went back to continue getting ready for the invasion. It seems as though that I ran this unit on my own, doesn't it? That's not true, but I did seem to get called upon to do these special little jobs, probably due to my age and experience. Anyway, because then, of course, my brother was in the unit, I asked if I could go with him in his aircraft. He spent his 20th birthday in this concentration area. We hadn't been allowed any alcohol on the previous night, but because D-Day was put off, some managed to find its way into the camp, and we had just a little birthday party. And this was on the night of the night of the 5th. His birthday was actually on the 4th. But
which part of the battalion was he in?
He was in a rifle battalion. He was in a rifle company, but he was in the machine gun section. He was a machine gunner. I have actually some pictures there, if you want to look at them later on.
Do you remember which company he was in?
Well, the machine gun sections were split out among the companies. I don't know which actual company he was attached to, quite honestly. I know he's number 3 section of the machine gun platoon, and that's all I do know, really. But anyway, he went in one aircraft, and I went another, and we said goodbye on the airfield, and see you over there, and I never saw him again. Because I didn't get to the objective, and he did, and subsequently, 6 days later, he was killed. So I never did see him.
What was the crossing like in the aeroplane?
The actual crossing itself was quite good, quite smooth. In fact, I dozed off, so I don't know a great deal about it. But we got the sort of stand to about 10 minutes before we do to cross the coast anyway, and got ourselves all organised and made sure all our equipment was fit and our parachutes were nicely and comfortable on our bodies, and then we got the order to stand to the door, and the red light went on, and when the green flashed, out we jumped. The only problem was that I was number 18 in a stick of 20 men. Behind me was a man called Backhurst and the sergeant, Sergeant Garrett, who was to be the last man out. We had a bit of flak, not much, a bit of light flak as we went over. That part of the coast was fairly lightly defended, as a matter of fact. In fact, that's where the SOE blokes used to go in, over Cobourg, and we were about 8-9 miles from Cobourg flying in. And unfortunately, number 13, a rifleman called Page, got trapped in the door. It appears that his rifle, which was strapped to his leg, swung to one side and jammed across the door, and he couldn't get out. Well, the fellows behind him, of course, struggled to get him out because he was holding the whole stick up, threw him out, or pushed him out, and God knows where he landed, and to the best of my knowledge, he was never seen again. I never heard of him again, anyway. By that time, of course, we were far, far away from where we should have been, and the pilot turned round and intended to bring us back home. So there was a bit of an argument, and there are various stories about this argument, about Sergeant Garrett pulling out his pistol and saying, if you don't go round again and drop us, I'll shoot you, which, of course, was a bit ridiculous, because he never said that anyway. Anyway, the pilot was persuaded to fly round and drop us in again, so by that time we'd be probably 5 or 6 minutes late. And there was a bit more flak coming up by then. And we got the red light and stood to, and green light, and out we went. And much to my horror, when I looked down, I thought I was landing in the sea. All I could see was water. Just wherever I, as far as I could see, it was water. And then I realised that there were bushes or trees, treetops or something sticking up through this water, and that I was in fact landing in an area where we knew the Germans had flooded it specifically to stop us from landing there. And that in fact is what had happened. I landed in the marshes of the Dive Valley, about 7 miles away from where I should have been. It was dark, of course, and I landed about chest deep in water originally. I walked a few yards and fell into a deep ditch, and I had a stretcher bundle which was on a long cord. And this stretcher bundle plummeted down into the depths. And we found out much, much later that these were drainage ditches which cover the whole of this area of the Deves Marshes. And they average about 6 feet deep and 9 feet wide. And they're connected with lots of little ditches as well to keep the whole area drained. Well, as I said, the Germans had deliberately flooded this area, so we couldn't see any of these ditches at all. And, of course, it was dark. And I heard splashing, and I called out. Our password was Punch, and the countersign was Judy. And I called out, Punch, no reply, splash, splash. Punch, no reply, splash, splash. Punch, give me an answer or I shall shoot. And a little voice said, Judy. And it turned out to be a fellow called Deuce, who was a company signaller, who had a radio and a battery pack. Well, he too had fallen into the water, and in the end he abandoned his battery pack altogether, just dumped it. My stretcher bundle was at the bottom of a ditch somewhere. And after a few moments, we found two other fellows wandering, a Lance Corporal Green and a Private Penstone, both riflemen. Now, this particular section of the company, they were in A Company, and they were the men who were supposed to have the Bangalore torpedoes to push under the wire and blast a hole in the wire so we could get through when we got to the battery. Do you know what Bangalore torpedoes are?
Yes.
Okay, well, these were a Bangalore torpedo crew, and although the majority of the stick of men got to the battery, those after Page, after number 12, didn't make it. Page, as I say, I don't know what happened to him anyway. David Deuce, Mitzi Green, Lance Corporal, Doug Penston and myself were a group together. Backhurst, the man behind me, he made it, but we never saw him again. And we never saw Sergeant Garrett, who was just two behind me. We never saw them on the ground again. But they both got through because we saw them after the war at a reunion. We four didn't know where we were. We knew we were in a triangle of land. To the north of us had to be the channel. It couldn't be anywhere else. To the right-hand side, which is the east of us, we could see some very high land. And to the left, there were some woods also on high ground. So we'd been well briefed before about the area in which we were to drop and what the other battalions would be doing. And we knew that the high ground with trees on was probably the Bois de Bavant, which was the objective of the 8th Battalion. We knew that the Merville Battery was only about 3 miles from the coast, so we had to be south of that. And the flat land to our left, to the west, would be the area of the River Deves, of the River Orne, and the Caen Canal, and the flat land to the left of that, which is not very high at all. All this, of course, became apparent to us when we got a bit of daylight as dawn broke. At that time, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, I think, began to get light. So we had a rough idea of where we were. But what we didn't know is where we were in actual relationship to the place that we were heading for, the Merville Battery, or our rendezvous. But we'd also been briefed that during the time we were making our attack, shortly following that, the commandos would be landing on the coast. And we were told, and I'm quite definite about this, we were told that we were landing at Franceville Plage and fighting their way east to occupy Cobourg on the night of the 6th of June. Now, that was definitely in the 9th Battalion's briefing. So we worked out that if we headed north, we'd got to hit the channel, we'd got to hit the coast road, which you knew ran from Cobourg to Wistram, right along the coast, and with any luck, we'd run into the commandos, who'd point us in the right direction to where our own people were. So we set off, heading north. We all had these little button compasses, that just a little spot on a fly button, or a wherever we cared to put it. And in any event, by that time we knew the sun, even in France, rose in the east, so we knew where north was. So we headed for the coast. Well, we kept on falling into these ditches, and eventually we found a long sapling which had broke off, and I went ahead probing. The two riflemen had their rifles, and I had a pistol. Deuce didn't have a weapon at all, he'd lost his rifle. And we saw ahead of us a building which was partly submerged, and we didn't know whether it was a pillbox or an outpost or what, so we looked very carefully and decided that we'd have a go at it, and it turned out to be a deserted cottage, and the ground floor of which was completely covered with water. And there was a bed in there, a double bed, with nothing on it, no mattress or anything. So bear in mind that we'd been walking through this water, paddling through these marshes, falling into ditches, and we're pretty tired and a bit knackered, and we wanted to think what we're going to do next. So we took it in turns to lie on this bed, and as we lay on it, it sank into the water. So actually lying in water, although supported by a spring. Anyway, we decided that we had to make a move, and in the distance we could see a church spire of a peculiar shape. And during our briefing we'd been shown picture postcards of various we've been shown maps, of course, but a lot of picture postcards and holiday pictures. Area, and one of them was of the church at Cobourg. So I thought, well, if we head for Cobourg, we're going to run right into the commandos. Let's do that. Now, a lot of these Norman churches have got something that we don't see so much over here. They have a tower and a roof going up on top of the tower, which then leads into a spire, and they're fairly distinctive. Now, a lot of the Norman churches have got them, but of course we didn't know that at the time. But we did know that Cobourg Church had this particular shaped spire, so we thought that's a good landmark, we'll head for that. And it was in the right direction. So we set off again, and then we hit the River Dive, and there's no way that we could get across it at all. So we had to backtrack a bit, and eventually we found there was a sort of tributary which led off to the east, and we followed that round, and there was a ruined bridge with just the no actual floor to it at all, but the handrail and the steel girder upon which the handrail rested was still there. So we made our way across that towards what appeared to be a farm building on the outskirts of Cobourg. Now, once again, we weren't certain whether this would be one of these fortified farms that we'd been warned about, been told about, and we weren't quite certain whether to head for it, or head for Cobourg, or what to do. And much to our surprise, we saw a canoe, not a boat, but a canoe coming towards us from the direction of this building. And in it was an elderly man with a flat cap and a pullover, who said, "Come, come, come, veet, veet, veet," which we knew meant quickly, quickly, quickly. And he came out and picked us up one at a time and took us back to this farm, which is where we met the Vermagine family. Now, the reason he'd come out to get us in the canoe was the fact that between us and the farm was a small river called the Divette, which we wouldn't have been able to get across. Although we did find that a bit further along the in the direction we weren't actually walking, we were going to miss it, there was a bridge there again, almost underwater. So this chap in the canoe took us out and took us back to the farm one at a time, and there we met the Vermagine family. Now, can I stop for a minute? As usual, I was the first one to go, and I rode across, or paddled across, to the farmyard, which was just above water. The approach road from Cobourg to the farm was underwater in both directions, to the depth of the hubs on a bicycle wheel towards the town, and running out into the marsh where it was totally submerged beyond the limits of the farm anyway. The only part of the farm actually above water was the main courtyard and buildings, and a Dutch barn, and a bit of orchard which had water in it, but only about ankle deep. The farm itself was a very substantial stone-built, L-shaped building. The main living area was parallel to the road, and that at right angles to the building and the road, and almost a link connector to the two, had a cider press and dairy, and barns above it, and barns above the right-hand side, which seems to be a storage area. The actual courtyard itself was part gravelled and part paved. There was also a large Dutch barn, which appeared to be for fodder storage, but at that time was empty. The man who brought us back in the canoe was what we would know as the farm foreman, and he looked like, well, a typical agricultural labourer. But we were greeted, or I was greeted, in the farmyard by Monsieur Adrian Vermegen and his wife Yvonne, his daughter Monique, and a little girl called Mart Rierbouw, who worked actually in the farm, worked for Madame Vermegen. They were obviously concerned about why we were there, although they thought it must be the debarquement, and very pleased, but a little scared to see us. And I did tell them that I introduced myself, of course, said who we were, why we were there, what our objective was, and that I'd got three other companions with me, and how we'd come to be in the marshes. In the meantime, the farm foreman, Georges, had been to get the other three. We could only bring back one at a time. Well, we were wet. We were wet through because we'd been wading through these marshes, and our feet felt as though they were blocks of ice. And so the first thing we wanted to do was to get our boots and socks off and get a drink. Well, he showed us where we could hide in the barn, which was adjacent to the farmhouse and up a ladder, and he made signs that he would bring us food and drink. So we whipped off our boots and socks, and by this time it was late afternoon and warm and sunny, and we put our boots on a window ledge and hung our socks over the window ledge to dry, and shot up the stairs, up the ladder, into this loft, which had a lot of hay stored up there, and also quite a bit of it spread around on the floor of the loft itself. We just got ourselves settled down. Madame Vermegen had brought us a basket of wild strawberries and a drink. I forget what the drink was at this moment, but I know we had something to drink. And all of a sudden, I heard a commotion in the yard downstairs. They had a dog called Moustique, which is French for mosquito, and this dog was barking its head off. So Madame Vermegen apparently went to the gate of the farm to see what was going on, looked up towards Cobourg, and saw two German soldiers coming down the road. She immediately, of course, was afraid that we'd been spotted. And she said, you know, keep quiet, keep quiet. And I suddenly remembered that these boots and socks were hanging on a windowsill in full view of anyone who came into the yard. So I dashed down the ladder, barefooted, of course, into the yard, got these socks, threw them behind the cider press, and there wasn't really room for me as well. So I shot back up the ladder, and I just got to the top when the Germans came into the yard. Now, it transpired, in fact, they hadn't seen us at all. Fortunately, this farm being a very large building, and being surrounded on two sides by about a 6 foot high, 5 or 6 foot high stone wall, had been hidden from the area in which they were coming. And they'd simply come to see if there were any eggs and milk. Madame Vermishing got rid of them as quickly as she could, and we all breathed a sigh of relief. So then we came down and milled around for a bit, had a talk. My French was very, very, very short on the ground. I didn't speak much French at all. They didn't speak any English, but we managed to make ourselves understood. Now, their elder daughter, Jacqueline, was away in Paris. She was at school in Paris and staying there with, in Caen, and staying there with friends.